call to order this meeting of the hearing of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee, Monday, March 1st. We have the minutes from February 24th. You know, there's one correction to a name under on the first page under Senate File 2386. It's Richard Heller of St. Paul, not Hiller. Are there other corrections? Senator Vickerman moves approval of the minutes of February 24th. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. First bill before us is Senate File 2397, Senator Prettner-Solin. We will be going slightly out of order with the bills. Senate File 2518 will be heard last. This meeting is going to conclude at 5 o'clock, if not sooner.
Okay.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This is a bill that you heard about a week or two ago, and it's here for a minor revision. And my understanding is that it actually there is an A1 amendment, if somebody would.
We'll consider that an author's amendment, since, once again, this is a committee of origin. Senator Pappas moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Prettner-Solin, now this does this get the order and length of terms of the members of the Spirit Mountain, whatever it is, Spirit Mountain Recreational Activity Authority in the sequence that you want?
Madam Chair, it gets in the sequence they want. It's not the one I would have recommended, but it apparently appoints four members 1 year, five members another year, and then there's 1 year when no members are replaced. And basically, I don't think what this does is just extend the term of the first two new members so that it creates that.
A staggered term that, thing for
right.
each of them. Okay. There's no request for another committee. Senator Marty moves that Senate File 2397, as amended, be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passed. Thank you very much,
Thank you
Senator
very
Prettner-Solin,
much.
For reconsidering that and coming back. We do appreciate it. Senator Olsen. Senator Olsen brings us Senate File 2286.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have the A2 amendment. This is the second committee it's been at, but this amendment would put it in the same form as in the bonding bill in case the bonding bill doesn't go forward.
We still need to discuss it, Senator Olsen, since this is not the committee of origin. So Senator Olsen offers the A2 amendment. Would you like to explain the A2 amendment, please?
Yeah, it just matches the language that is in the bonding bill. It basically says, it adds words like at 114, I think it says, after renovation or demolition. So it's just more encompassing language that would you prefer me to maybe go over the bill briefly first? Or?
Sure.
Okay. This Senate File 2286 is a bill that will establish that state bonding projects that are over $5 million and are within 40 miles of a recycling facility, the materials from the demolition or the rebuilding or recycling would be used or would be recycled. So that's basically the bill in a nutshell, and there's
been doing this in Wisconsin. Is that right?
Right. They started it in Wisconsin as a kind of a nonprofit effort, and now they've made that into a law starting this year also. And they've had pretty good success with it.
And are there any questions or comments about the A2 amendment that Senator Olsen is proposing in order to match the language in the bonding bill that was that's currently being reconsidered? Senator Olsen, is that correct?
Correct.
The language that was in the bonding bill that passed, not the one that's coming back necessarily.
Right. This language would line them up so that they would be the same, and you know, hopefully that bill does go forward, but if it's not, then this bill would be available.
Chairman Schaefer-Pellin, and there was no request for this bill to go anywhere but the floor. Okay. Any questions for Senator Olsen? Anybody want to speak about Senate File 2286? Have we voted on the amendment? We have Senator Olsen's A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olsen.
To the bill, I kind of snuck off last Friday and went with a friend of mine who has a disposal business. We went up to Sharona, Wisconsin to look at a landfill there. They were depositing 2,000 to 3,000 tons of waste material a day. And, you know, a lot of that's garbage, granted. But the point for me was brought in very clear home why this bill would be a valuable bill, because you know, there is in a lot of these rebuilding projects and construction projects, there's a lot of materials that can be recycled, whether it's blacktop from a driveway, concrete, or wood products. Or there's an awful lot of materials that, you know, don't need to go into a landfill. And this bill would, I think it would be a model for other industries if they see they're bidding on a state bonding bill project, that they have to do this, and I think they would see the dollar savings for them in the bottom line, that they would just start. And as a matter of fact, a lot of construction projects are doing this now, but I think it would be a good indicator the state could kind of take a lead on this one.
So, Senator Olsen, you said this language is in the bonding bill. It connected to a project or just as policy language?
I think it's policy language, Madam Chair.
Why is there policy language?
I can't answer that, Madam Chair.
Anybody know? Senator Siemens? Mr. Bonner?
Madam Chair, this language is generally applicable to how bonding proceeds are spent.
I see. So it is appropriate for it to be there. So I don't understand why it's not going to a finance committee.
Pardon me?
I don't understand why it's not going to the finance committee, if that's the case. But it may get pulled back, Senator Olsen. But we haven't heard anything about it, so we're going to let it go to the floor.
Madam Chair, the bill actually can sell itself, so I
okay.
A few stops doesn't bother. Oh, and I'd like to add that Department of Administration testified that we put in non-hazardous materials. Mm-hmm. They were concerned that so we put that language in, and then I believe the 40 miles. So then I think they're fine with the bill also.
Okay, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, when you have 50% standard in here, what's the most you could get if you tore down a building like this? I mean, well, not this, because this is so much stone you could recycle, but right. Typical office building or something.
Well, I think 50%, Madam Chair, I think 50% is a good average. I mean, there is a lot of material that is reusable, and we talk about non-hazardous. So then if there's any asbestos or hazardous material like that, that would. And in the older buildings, I mean, they used to line a lot of the pipes with asbestos. So,
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, so a number of years from now, it might go, I mean, we might be doing 70, 80% of stuff at some point.
Madam Chair, I could easily see that.
Olsen.
The wood could just, you know, maybe go to a digester or a RFD furnace to produce electricity, or, you know, and the steel. I mean, steel is the easiest to recycle, and so I see those numbers going up, yes.
Senator Sieben?
Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, to be clear, is your intention that this would apply to any state building project or just to state buildings? Because I see some discrepancy in the language on 1.9 and then the language that was in the amendment.
Madam Chair and Senator Stephen, we had that discussion, and the discussion was that because it addresses in the top part of the bill that it says that with bonding proceeds of over $5 million, let's see. That, I guess that now, Madam Chair, that's a 1.5 of the amendment. So it addresses construction and renovation projects of over $5 million. And it should say in bonding also. And 1.3 of the amendment from bond proceed funds. So it would be for, say, projects that were in the bonding bill.
Senator Olstein, I'm just wondering if the language then on lines 1.9 might need to be reworked, because it says in contract for the construction, renovation, or demolition of a state building. And I think that's a little bit unclear whether that would apply just to a building that the state owns, or whether, for instance, it would be a Minsky building or anything else that the bonding bill funds.
Oh, Madam Chair, I understand your line of questioning. That's a fair question, because our intention is that it's any building that's funded by the bonding bill. So
I think you need another amendment then, or define.
I would entertain any suggestion on that, Madam Chair.
Mr. McGowan or Mr. Bodern, so that it applies to state or bonding projects, not just, quote, state government buildings.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Olstein.
The concern, I guess, would be that as I'm thinking back on this, I think they wanted to start with buildings that are, like, under the control of the Department of Administration. But you're right, that would probably eliminate Minsky or University of Minnesota, which are the biggest ones. So, Madam Chair, maybe I should lay this on the table or
you want to do that?
Yes, and get a real correct answer for that.
And when you and that would give us a chance also, that with the amendment we put on already, to just inquire whether finance would like to once again see the bill.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I think that would be appropriate to do, Senator Steven, it brings up a good point, because we want it to be Minsky buildings and University of Minnesota. So,
we would then take this bill up first on the agenda of a next meeting.
So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to lay this on the table.
Senate file 2286 is laid over. Senator Betzel. Senator Betzel brings us Senate File 2644, which is a transfer of the MRF administrative functions to PERA. Senator Betzel.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. The Pensions Commission, which consists of 5 members of the Senate, 5 members of the House, has been working since last June to try to put together a pension bill, which this committee will see in about 2 weeks. Both Senator Pappas and I serve on the Pensions Commission. I chair it. But there's one issue which we did not want to delay, and we moved it ahead, and that's the issue we have before us. So this is not the whole pension bill. This is only one issue. But there's a funding component here that, as I say, we need to get it in the mix with the budget issues that are facing us. You've got a number of handouts in your packet talking about MRF, the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. And
well, do you want to
We've got a 4A amendment. And this is a little unusual because, again, this is the Committee of Origin, maybe the Pensions Commission, and the bill that you have before us is the Pensions Commission bill. But
they can't act on a bill.
They can't
such,
act on
so
well, we can actually prepare our bills and send them out. But the 4A amendment would put the bill in the shape that right now is needed to make some corrective changes to the bill. So I'll move the 4A amendment.
Okay. And the with this bill, do we need to adopt a delete everything amendment first? Do you have?
No. No. What had happened was,
where's the language of the bill itself?
The Pension Commission issue that we have.
Okay, so it's here. Okay, so 2644 is introduced. We have in there, and now there is an A4 amendment, right. But there was a 1A amendment too. Do you not want to take that up?
And to be clear, Madam Chair, The bill you have, 2644, was as it was introduced. The Foray Amendment actually represents three different amendments as they were adopted by the Pension Commission.
Okay.
So what you have before us has been approved by the Pension Commission.
Okay, so the 1A amendment is not going to come before us. Is that correct?
No. We have our own amendment filing system. The 1A, 2A, and 3A amendments adopted by the Pension Commission are represented in the 4A amendment
that's
before this committee.
That's what I needed to know. So we have the 4A amendment, and it is an author's amendment. Senator Betzel moves adoption of the 4A amendment, S26444A. All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now the bill is before
and Madam Chair,
us
just
as approved by the Pension Commission.
Correct.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair and members, the you need to understand a little bit of background of the MRF program in order to understand the situation that they're in today. It's one of the oldest pension plans in the state, established in 1919. And for the years of it was closed in 1979. And it basically encompassed every government employee who worked in the city of Minneapolis. Many of them worked for the city of Minneapolis or the Minneapolis School District. Some worked for Hennepin County. Some worked for the Metropolitan Airports Commission. If you worked in Minneapolis, you were part of MRF. By the late 70s, it was quite obvious that this plan really was too restrictive and narrow, and that these employees probably were better suited in other plans. For instance, Minneapolis Teachers had a Minneapolis Teachers Fund established. Minneapolis City employees or Hennepin County employees really belong in PERA, which is where other state local government employees are in a statewide plan. So that's why the fund was ultimately closed out. Because it was an older plan, a lot of assumptions by the actuaries that were made from the 40s and 50s and even the 60s probably did not hold up in the long run. For example, if you were a MRF employee, you could retire after 30 years. Now, that means if you went to work for the city or the school district as age 22 years old, after 30 years you could retire. That's not true today, obviously. If you were age 60, regardless of the number of years, you could retire. The assumptions back then were that you'd probably be dead by the time you're age 65. Those haven't held up. In fact, we have MRF retirees that are over 100 years old now, people who have been drawing their retirement checks longer than they ever worked for the city or worked for the government. So there's a number of things that have caused the long-term funding to go out of whack. The stock market has obviously taken its toll on this fund as others. And to be honest, they had an executive director who was a former member of the Minnesota Senate who managed that fund or mismanaged that fund and caused significant losses because of bad decisions he made, bad loans he made. Some of that money was recaptured by insurance, but it also took – but there's a number of factors. But probably the biggest factor that's hurting the fund is that it's been closed to new members since 1979. Pension funds are – paid for by employer and employee contributions. Government employees and government units basically pay for the funds, and then the money's invested. Now, when you have a closed fund at some point down the road, as is particular in this one, you're going to run out of new employees helping to foot the bill. MRF right now has not quite 5,000 retirees drawing checks. You can't go after them for contribution increases because they're not working anymore. They've got less than 200 active members, people actually still working. The average age of a MRF MRF member is about 79 years old. So there's not a lot of way you can go there. In recent years, there have been attempts to try it out. Put some new money into the fund. The state has a standard appropriation into MRF that we've had for a couple of years. It's about $9 million. The $9 million from the state of Minnesota represents about over half of the money that MRF gets. They still get money from the city of Minneapolis, Minneapolis school districts as the major employees, plus the minor employees as well, too. But the situation that they're in right now is that you look down the road, their actuaries, independent actuaries, everybody's looked at this, and we've got people here to flesh out the numbers, is that best case is that they got about 7 to 10 years before this fund goes broke. And worst case, about 5 years. That is, they're going to run out of money. They won't have the money to pay any more retirement checks. Now, this is significant because, again, this is an older fund. These employees were not tied into Social Security. They get higher benefits than if they had been on Social Security, because with Social Security, it's kind of coordinated. You get your Social Security check, and then you get a check to kind of from the government pension to make up the difference. This was not coordinated that way, which means that if the fund goes broke, these retirees have nothing. They have no Social Security. They become basically wards of the state if the fund becomes broke. And kicking the can down the road, waiting to hope things get better, is going to make the matter far worse. We've been given different numbers. In January, I was told that it would take a $90 million contribution from whatever source over the next couple of years to keep the fund stable. What this bill does, it does require significant increases by the city of Minneapolis, by the Minneapolis School Board, and these other entities. But from the state standpoint, and that's obviously the focus that I'm going to have to take to the Finance Committee, and that's the reason why we have the bill now as opposed to waiting, is it would require a state contribution of $27.5 million per year beyond, over and above the $90 million that we are currently spending. Now, that's the fiscal aspect of it. The procedural aspect, how this bill is structured, if I can call your attention to a memo that is prepared by our Pension Commission staff. It's the State of Minnesota Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. This is a typical memo that is prepared by the Pensions Commission staff. It was prepared by Larry Martin, who is the executive director. He's seated to my left. And just a brief summary, as you can see on that memo, it provides, there's a consolidation of MRF into PERA and PERA General. Now, we're not a complete rollover consolidation. PERA is rightly worried about consolidating MRF into their fund. I think they're happy to take the members in. They're not so happy about taking the liabilities in. They don't want to assume liabilities of over $30 million a year or whatever it is for many years to come out of their other funds. And they are rightly concerned about that. They're rightly concerned about the fact that even the funding mechanism we have in here, what happens if the future legislature changes that and say, well, you have to eat some costs. They're worried about that, but this is a proposal we have before us. It does require the current and future MRF employees are going to get less post-retirement adjustments, cost of living increases. They have received some very good increases in recent years. The fund simply cannot sustain that. Instead of getting index of 3.5% increase on plus an additional amount for the five-year experience ratings, they're going to get a 2.5% annual adjustment. Obviously, with inflation being down, even Social Security has a 0% cost of living increase for a two-year period. So this is consistent with what's going on elsewhere. We're going to shift MRF into PERA, but it's going to be accounted for separately, not, again, as part of PERA's funds. We're going to start assuming the PERA actuarial assumptions, not the separate MRF assumptions. As I say, there's going to be some current and state funding. As I say, that's the biggest part of it. The biggest part is the increase by the state. Ultimately, when all this is done, we anticipate to be a full merger with PERA General. But as I say, a lot of these issues have to be resolved, and making sure it is on a proper funding standpoint so that PERA does not assume liabilities it did not wish to have. Madam Chair, that's it in a nutshell. I do have the Executive Director for PERA as the Executive Director for MRFRA here to answer any questions.
Madam Chair.
Question, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzelt, we passed this bill out of our Pension Commission several weeks ago, but during our last meeting last Friday, we were talking about a lower cost of living adjustments. TRA is proposing a two-year freeze, and PERA is proposing 1%, at least for the next couple of years. I don't remember. I wonder if we need to revisit this 2.5% post-retirement adjustment.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair.
Sorry to make you talk.
No. Around here, not being able to talk has its upsides and its downsides.
Usually sick people, we encourage them to stay home.
Yeah. Well, I had to chair my own budget division today, and I had to present the bill here today. It is true that now we're going to be coming through with a bigger bill with dealing with the current funds, TRA, MSRS, PERA. And we are recommending a rollback in cost of living increases for them. I think from what MRF was looking at, what they felt they could do and what they could sustain, that's it. Now, Senator Pappas, obviously, although the bill has, we did send a bill out from the Pension Commission, and that is it here. We also kept the language within the Pension Commission in the omnibus bill, so that if it's the will of the Pension Commission to revisit that issue, which we'll be doing on Friday when we have our, what probably will be our last meeting of the year, we can certainly discuss it there. You know, so I think that that's probably an issue that the Pension Commission needs to look at as opposed to here. But, you know, you're raising a point that maybe we need to just make sure we're consistent.
Right. Madam Chair, let's not present that.
Campus.
The MRF adjustments are tied to the PERA adjustments.
The MRF adjustments are actually tied to the proposed PERA adjustments. So to that extent, it'd be consistent to PERA.
Great.
Yeah.
That's fine. Then.
Senator Perry.
Page 24, lines 21 and 22. Page 24, lines 21 and 22.
Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I just want to go back here and clarify what I thought you said. The $27 million would be on that they're asking would be on top of the $90 million a year we already fund?
$9 million.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair. Senator Perry, we currently give $9
million. $9 million.
A month ago, we were told that the increased contribution could be as high as $90 million. The numbers that you've got from the state contribution, all the other ones, I don't think reach $90 million, and I don't think we could get there. But at least, you know, this is what we think we could do. But the $27.5 million would be on top of the $9 million that we are currently.
And that's an ongoing cost then?
Yes, it would be. Now, at some point, it'll taper off because, you know, as these MRF employees, you know, start dying off and so forth, you don't need to maintain that level of contribution. It's not like the last person is going to win the lottery. So you'll be able to sort of taper it off, but for the foreseeable future, that's the contribution we'd have to be looking at.
Anyone have any further questions or comments for Senator Betzel? Mr. Martin is also here. Senator Gerlach.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzel, I don't serve on the Pension Commission, and I'm not familiar with a lot of the terms and details and the history of some of these, but we've talked a number of times about how MRF is a closed fund, and the fact sheet here mentions it several times how that's a problem. Somebody would. Why was it closed, and wasn't the situation predictable then? If you close a fund, automatically you choke it off over time, it's going to be in a position as it is today?
I think Mr. Martin
Senator
might be able
Betzel.
To give a better – we've got a sort of a history background within the packet by the pension fund. I think it was just deemed in the long run not workable to have every city employee in one fund when there were other funds that were more appropriate for that. But yes, if you close out a fund, a day of reckoning is going to happen down the road, because the lifeblood of a public pension fund are the employer and employee contributions plus the investments that you get off of them. At some point, as you've seen here, there are no more employee contributions. And if you have bad actuarial assumptions or incorrect ones, they're probably correct actuarial assumptions when they're made in the 50s and 60s. But today, you wouldn't assume that somebody could retire at age 60 and live to age 65. I mean, that's not, but that wasn't anticipated back then. So the contribution increases were set on what they expected down the road, that and many other factors. Nobody, I mean, even a few years ago, MRF was sitting rather well as a well-funded fund. The stock market crashed. There's a lot of things that happened that, you know, all these things kind of came together in recent years to make the MRF fund in as dire shape as it's in. Now, Mr. Martin can probably comment on some of the, you know, the reason why it was closed out and so forth, if I missed
it. Mr. Martin, if you identify yourself, please, for the committee.
Yes, members, I'm Larry Martin, the Executive Director of the Pension Commission. Senator Betzold has indicated that a closed fund is part of the problem here. That when you close a pension fund, that limits your options to correct funding downfalls, funding declines, as occurred recently. As late as in 2002, MRF was over 93% funded, had an unfunded of less than $100 million. And now it has an unfunded of something like $800 million and is well less funded than 90%. With almost no active members, you have limited options in looking to the regular funding sources, at least that regular funding source, to try and reverse the circumstances. The city of Minneapolis was pursuing back in the late 70s to answer the question why was MRF closed. They were trying to reduce the actuarial cost of the Minneapolis pension program as a basic program with a very early our retirement age. The city of Minneapolis first recommended consolidating MRF with PERA and covering all new hires by PERA. The legislature chose not to do that in the late 70s, did create a MRF coordinated program coordinating with Social Security, which was mirroring PERA at that time. About a year later, the city of Minneapolis came back for a second try, did not get a consolidation of MRF at that time, but the MRF coordinated program was consolidated with PERA, and that was the start of the phase-out of MRF back in 1978-79.
Terry Gerlach, okay. Further question?
Sure, Madam Chair, and just one, but it may not be, I guess, appropriate for us for the policy committee, but I guess I'm wondering if there's been any thought to put in to how we're going to pay for this at all, or is this just sent on to the finance committee ultimately and they'll figure that out?
We certainly, I think, can ask for explanation or discussion of that, but that issue obviously is a finance committee issue with in detail and the bill as it moves along. I mean, this next stop is the finance committee and to consider that. I mean, I think the accuracy of the number is one thing that would be important to us, but where they get the money to do it. Just as we get a number of bills in this committee with blank appropriations and the fiscal note is not written in the policy committee, it's only written when a bill gets to the finance committee. Okay. So I think if you have questions, go ahead and ask them, but this would not be the place where that would be determined.
Sure. Okay. Well, thanks, Madam Chair. Just so I understand, because I don't serve on the finance committee, Senator Betzold, so we're looking at that in addition to that $9 million, $27.5 million per year, or in the actuarial life of this program then, or this fix, is that somewhere in the neighborhood of, did I read it, it's $550 million or somewhere over $500 million then to resolve the issue? Is that accurate?
I probably need to get the fund director up here.
Good afternoon. If you would identify yourself for the record, Senator Gerlach has some questions for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Luther Thompson. I'm the part-time executive director at MRF. I've been there a little over a year now trying to resolve this problem.
Mr. Thompson, Senator Gerlach, do you want to ask your question again?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Thompson, the question is about, I just want to get a handle on the dollars. I know I understand the proposal, the bill proposal, but it sounds like it's $27.5 million per year for a period of years, kind of of the life of this fix, and that would total over $500 million when all is said and done. Is that a correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, there's about $1.6 billion in liabilities and about $800 million in assets. The numbers we're speaking of, with the last actuarial report, that's July 1 of 2009, there was an unfunded deficiency of $73 million a year with an amortization date of 2020. That was a large number. What's in the bill is pushing the amortization date out to 2031.
Oh, okay.
That reduces that unfunded deficiency down to about $50 million. Currently, about $15 million is coming into MRF at the present time, $9 million from the state and then about $6 million from the other employers. So then the $27.5 million, we were asked to look at the proportion of the state's contribution and the employer's contribution over a recent period of time. So over the last 5 years, the state's proportion has been 55%. So the $27.5 million came from taking the $50 million times 55%.
I see. Okay.
Senator Roebling. Or Senator Gerlach?
Go ahead.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Thompson. I'm wondering what happens to the deficiency. How greatly is it affected if the cost of living adjustment? Have you done some different scenarios, like if it's frozen for 2 years or 3 years, and then if it is set at 1% instead of this proposed 2.5%? How much of an impact do holding down cost of living adjustments have on it?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. Unfortunately, there's a couple problems with the statute. Currently, MRF pays up to 3.5%. So what happened in 2010, MRF retirees got zero cost of living as contrasted with the large pension funds who had a fixed 2.5. So we didn't pay out any cost of living this year. Now, you would expect that if you lowered the cost of living, you would get an actuarial saving. Unfortunately, what's in statute requires the cost of living to be factored at 1%. There's a 5% post-retirement earnings assumption and a 6% pre-retirement earnings assumption. So that's a defect in the statute that should have been corrected a long time ago. The other major defect, and really, you know, you have this whole history about all the things that did go wrong, but in 2007, the legislative auditor recommended that the way the post fund was valued, and there were at that time only two post funds, the general post fund for para, MSRS, and TRA, and the post fund for MRF. Because back in 82, MRF was part of that post fund, but they allowed the executive director to pull that money out and manage it themselves. But what happened in 2007, people recognized that there was a deficiency in the post fund. Unfortunately, the statute required that the assets in the post fund be valued at the liability level and not the market level. So it masked any deficiency if you were below 100% funding. So starting in 2007 is when this deficiency first showed up. And again, there's a defective and confusing statute for MRF because it required the billings be based upon the value of the deficiency except for the post fund. And in the statute it says is that the post fund would be set equal to the liabilities and not the market. So when you sent out the bill to the employers, any deficiency in the post fund was completely masked. And 95% of the liabilities for MRF exist in the post fund. So starting in 2007, a $12 million unfunded deficiency showed up. Nothing was done about that. The next year, it became $30 million. And then, of course, we had certainly the significant downturn in the market, and last year that went to $73 million a year. This fund, it's an actuarial certainty that it will be in default in that 5 to 10 year range. There is no reasonable economic expectation that you will get out of that. This is about the last chance for a legislative solution, because these retirees, as anxious as they are to have this resolved, cannot wait till the checks stop, because legal action does require a certain amount of time and a certain amount of uncertainty. So we're at the end of the road here.
Sarah Roebling?
I noticed from this fact sheet that was handed out that it says the legislature makes all decisions regarding MRF's benefits, funding, and closure. And maybe that is true now, but I wonder if it was always true. Like, for example, when the stock market was performing well, did we have it capped at 3.5% for the COLA, or was there a board that could choose to give to pay out higher COLAs in those years when the stock market was doing well?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, the mechanism for the MRF post fund adjustments was similar to what it was for PARA, MSRS, and TRA. What happened was is that if you had 5 consecutive years where you had positive returns and it was fully funded, then you would share in that the investment returns, and that's what the retirees would get. That's why you had those large increases in the 90s. You paid a cost of living up to, which was then 2.5%, and then you got these other increases. Now, when the other three funds went from an up to 3.5% COLA down to an up to 2.5% COLA, there was a switch, and the retirees got a benefit to offset that decrease in the COLA. But MRF never did participate in that, and that was in the latter part of the 90s when that took place.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
The legislature does basically set a lot of the rates and assumptions that come into the pension plans. And, of course, we rely upon the recommendations from the funds and, you know, the information that we can get from the actuaries. One of the things that's, for instance, in statute is that we assume that when they invest their money, they're going to get an 8.5% return, which is not holding true right now. And, in fact, you know, and as I said, you'll see this in the major bills as they come forward to us. We're being told that for the major funds, not only can they not make 8.5% interest over the next 30 years, if they got 8.5% interest, some of the major funds would go broke before 30 years. But they'd have to have 12% over the next 10 years just to avoid losing ground. Or if we're lucky, we can have 19% over 3 years to avoid losing ground. But these are set in statute because these are assumptions the legislature has told pension funds to make. One of the problems that we had in the funds in the 90s was that because the economy was white hot, and the funds were doing extremely well with their investments, a lot of the retirees came to the Capitol and they said, you know, we have not had our benefits have not increased anywhere as near what the cost of living has gone up. You know, we only get this 1 and 2% over the years, and look at what, you know, the stock market's doing. Look how well the funds are doing. So decisions were made, you know, less so with MRF, but to roll back the contribution from the employer-employee and to actually, you know, pay out better benefits because the money was there. Well, you know, unfortunately, by rolling back the contributions and by paying out higher benefits and locking them in for a long period of time, that's caused drains on the funds. But that's just an example of how, you know, the legislature sets the policies based upon the information we've got. Now, had the good times in the 90s been continuing, as people were telling us back then, I mean, you know, saying that this was going to go on forever, of course, we wouldn't have a problem today. But a convergence of a lot of events has said, okay, now we got to go back and rethink what we're doing to put these things on stable funds. We have, by the way, taken actions in recent years to prevent some of these things from happening again. For example, we're not going to, it's in statute, could be changed by future legislature, but we've put down and we say it's not a good idea to pay out large benefit increases in good times, because what are you going to do during bad times? So we've kind of put a cap on that. Again, that's a statute, but we're just as a signal in there saying, you know, just because the funds are flush with money doesn't mean you got to pay it out. So we've taken steps to change things and do things over the years, but you know that's across the board. So it is the legislature who has set the policies and the rates and so forth.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. When it says that basic benefits cannot be legally reduced, what are the basic benefits? Is it the amount they're currently receiving, or does it roll back to some other time? What is a basic benefit?
Senator Betzel or Mr. Thompson?
Can you answer?
Mr. Mart? Somebody?
Somebody.
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, certainly. What legally can be changed and not changed will be decided by the courts, presuming this doesn't get settled legislatively. I think there's, you know, you can ask your legal counsel, but there's various case law in the state of Minnesota. And what's happened is that there are some I think these benefits are treated as a contractual right. Now, I don't know what the courts would decide if this unfortunately has to go to the courts. I think basically we've certainly, when we're talking about reducing the COLAs, there are people that say that even that's subject to challenge. But at some point you have to weigh the benefits and the risks. And, you know, if a fund's going to go insolvent, then certainly I guess you have to look at the issue about is adjusting the COLA a reasonable alternative? And I think, you know, my opinion would be yes, you could do that. And we have suggested we're willing to take a reduction, that the MRF members and the MMRA are willing to take a reduction in the COLA, and even if PARA lowers their COLA, to take whatever PARA decides is appropriate for their membership.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling.
Senator Betzel.
The fact sheet you're referring to was prepared by MRF, so they're the ones who are going to have to explain it. She's referring to this part in here. Basic benefits cannot be legally reduced. I mean, that's the thing she's referring to.
Well, I think,
Mr. Thompson,
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, when they talk about the basic benefits, that would be what the person was entitled to receive at retirement, being whatever, you know, the formula multiplied by the years of service, and perhaps also, you know, the COLA. But I think it's less likely that, you know, a challenge to the COLA reduction would be upheld. That's about the best I can answer. I think the chances of reducing the COLA are justified at the present time. I don't think you could reduce the basic benefits without a severe legal challenge. And I don't know.
The basic benefit is that formula that
yes,
is the
ma'am.
Initial benefit that they
that's
get
my,
unaffected by the COLAs. Is that?
That would
that
be my
a common
opinion.
Sense
and,
way of
yes.
understanding
and it? I would say this fact sheet has been put together both by MMRA and MRF. MRF is unique in that MRA is a association of the retirees allowed to be created by statute. No other pension fund has an association like this. It's the MMRA association that elects the board members and really lobbies on behalf of them. There is no other pension fund that has that kind of an arrangement either.
Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, I'm just trying to get this through here. As I read, MRF has 8 employers. Have they always had just 8 employers?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Senator Perry, I believe that's true. What's happened historically, though, is that there's been various changes in the statute that either excluded certain employers and shifted the burden to others. But again, I think you have to look at all of those changes when it excluded perhaps MAC and non-metropolitan units. That might have been based on a false assumption that no one ever had to take on the liability of the post fund if it ever diminished. So some of those arrangements, I think, were based upon the assumption that the post fund would always remain fully funded and that the assets would always equal or exceed the liabilities.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry.
maybe you could answer when and where did the citizens of the state accept responsibility to maintain funds? And I have a disconnect here because I'm trying to figure out if these are the employers mm-hmm. that have been contributing and this is their fund, where and when did the state become responsible to make sure this doesn't go insolvent?
Okay.
Senator Betzel?
No, did you want to respond to my question? The history there. We have somebody from the city of Minneapolis here, too, who could also add some light to this. So.
Mr. Martin?
Yes, members. Lawrence Martin again. The city of Minneapolis in 1919 was the only employer for MRF. As things have been subdivided off of the city, for instance, the school district was created separate from the city sometime, I believe, in the 50s. So that's where special school district number one comes from. The airport was first a function of the Minneapolis Park Board and then eventually given to the Metropolitan Airports Commission. That's where the Airports Commission comes in. There was a sewer department in the city of Minneapolis. They were divvied off and given to the Metro Council, originally as part of the Metropolitan Waste Control Commission and now the Environmental Quality Division of the Met Council. The Minneapolis Community College used to be part of the school district, now is part of MNSCU, and hence a state employee. So that's where the various eight employers came from, originally the city of Minneapolis, but by dividing off various employee groups, some welfare employees, some library employees, are now Hennepin County employees by other transfers of employees. So that's where the eight employers came from.
Senator Perry? Madam Chair, I guess I'm still not clear because I haven't heard where and when the state of Minnesota ended up with the fiduciary responsibility to keep this plan solvent.
Just a second, Senator Betzold. Yep. Go ahead.
Welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Pat Bourne. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the City of Minneapolis.
Can you respond to Senator Perry's question?
I'll start. Okay. I am no historian. I want to let everybody know that first. The state, I think, began making contributions to this plan in the 1970s. Perhaps Mr. Martin, who actually is a historian of some repute about these matters, can tell you more and better than I can. But the state has been making contributions to this plan for quite some time. The plan that's proposed today would have the state make contributions in the same proportionality as it's been making, and the local employers would make the same contributions proportionally to what they have been making, albeit increases, sufficient to fully fund this plan between now and 2032, I think. So the state and the local contribution would increase, but proportionally to what they have been recently been. I don't know that I can explain all the reasons why the state may have started to make contributions or all the conditions that have caused that contribution to change over time. It's been more dollar-wise than it is today from time to time. But I think because the state plays this regulatory role, I'll describe it as a regulatory role with local pension plans, and the state plays this role of determining what the actuarial assumptions have been. The state and I think at the time this plan was closed to new members, I think that may have been the trigger that set off a set of contributions by the state and the local employers to fund that plan based on assumptions made at the time. I'm sorry that I can't be more specific about history, and perhaps others in the audience can be.
Senator Perry?
Madam Chair, I can see how back then that, you know, out of the goodness of our hearts, we committed citizens' dollars to this, but I still would like to know, is there a statute that legally binds us as the fiduciary responsibility to make sure that this MRF is solvent? I guess that's my real question. Are we, where does it say that we're obligated to increase 27.5 million a year and so on and so forth?
Well, go ahead.
Sir?
I'll take a stab at it. There isn't a statute that you're looking for, nor is there one that obligates any of the local employers to do the same thing. I think what we find ourselves in is this, in this situation where this pension plan is going to become insolvent in the near future, and we're all searching for a solution to assure that the retirees are going to get paid their basic pension benefits in some way, shape, or form. But no government under current law has an obligation to guarantee full funding. The state law doesn't allocate those responsibilities today to either the local employers or the state at this point.
And Madam Chair, where you can find it, in the state government budget bill, which I've carried in the Senate for the last 3 years, you know, just has a line item that has an appropriation for MRF. Now, let me point out that this is not a City of Minneapolis issue, although these employees originally worked somewhere within the boundaries of the City of Minneapolis. Most of them are retired, and they live all over the state right now. The comment was made at the Pension Commission where we were talking about this. Senator Mary Olson, who represents Bemidji, Representative Kahn represents the City of Minneapolis, part of the City of Minneapolis. Representative Kahn said, Senator Olson, you have more people, more MRF retirees in your district than I have in mine. Okay, so all of us, each one of us, have these retirees living within our district. So I just want to be sure that you're not focusing, saying this is somehow, you know, a City of Minneapolis problem, because it's much beyond that. And I just assume that the legislatures back in the, you know, 1970s saw, you know, this developing figure that it was just more than just one jurisdictional area. It belonged really more to the whole state. But, you know, normally the pension funds do have to pay for themselves. MSRS, which is for state employees, we do have an appropriation for them because, you know, again, the state's the employer, so we have to cover that. PERA is basically funded by property taxes. I mean, the local city and local governments have to pay for them. And then we have the school districts, TRA. They're paid for by the school districts, and they, you know, they find it partially out of the funding that we send by it, partially out of the levies that they pass. So it's a variety of funds. Ultimately, they are taxpayer dollars that have to pay for the employer share. Now, mind you, when you've taken the employer contribution and the employee contribution and you invest it, most of the money comes from the investments. That's where the real money is. Less so from the other two parts. It starts with the contributions from the employer and the employee.
Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, and you know, I can agree with that, but I still take issue with the fact that it doesn't make a difference where these past employee retirees live. It's where they worked, where they garnered this program, and I still go back to, I see nowhere in anything we've talked about where the citizens of this state are required to bail out this program. And that's what's concerning me, is that we're being asked to fund a program that was on its own, started on its own, and as far as I can tell, the only involvement the state has had is to help with setting the rates and that, and I don't know how the citizens are bound to. I'm still not clear on this. Where the citizens are bound, other than having big hearts, to fund this and move this forward.
Madam Chair, it's not. You know, I'll repeat it. You know, there's nothing in statute that says that we must do it, and if there were, the legislature could change that. Okay, it isn't about big hearts. This is about trying to make responsible decisions, which is what part of our job is around here. As I indicated, if it's the will of this legislature to let the fund go bankrupt in 5 to 7 years, that can happen. It doesn't mean these retirees go away. It just means that because they don't have Social Security, probably they become wards of the state. That means the state is probably going to have to assume 100% of taking care of their health care, somehow taking care of them because they have no income. They have nothing else. What's the proposal if the fund goes bankrupt? This is not a brand new issue from this year. I mean, we've been working on this for the last couple of years as it became, now we actually tried to get something done in the last two sessions. We just can't wait anymore. But if you're talking about some moral obligation, no, there's no moral obligation.
Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not going to debate that issue, but I just want to point out that these were all local government employees. And so any contribution that we make to this should really be considered local government aid, because these were not people that were employed by the state. They were employed and used for services by the local units of government. And, so I just, as we hear the outcry about cuts to local government aid, and then we're coming back and asking for state dollars for this, it is, in essence, local government aid. So we may be taking from one end, but if we feel obligated, and I'm not saying that we will, come up with all this $27 million, but we have been doing $9 million already a year, it is local government aid.
Well, any further questions or comments? Senator Gimsey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a bit curious about the discussion that was had about the potential for lawsuits revolving around this if we don't do anything as a state government. In the event that there is a potential lawsuit, who becomes the defendant in that litigation, and what is the state's exposure, would you say, to us not doing anything?
Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, I can't speculate what people may or may not do, but as Mr. Thompson indicated, they're not going to wait until the fund dries up and say, geez, we better start some action here. It's quite, when you start a lawsuit, you sue everybody in sight. You look for the deep pockets. The deepest pocket would be the state of Minnesota. City of Minneapolis, Minneapolis School Board, they've got pockets there too. But I think that if you're trying to make responsible decisions, you avoid getting to that point. But it's irrefutable that that day is coming, and the longer we wait, the more impossible it is to resolve it.
Senator Gimsey?
So did the Pensions Commission look at any precedents as far as what other state or what other retirement fund has ever gone through this before, and or are we in absolutely totally uncharted water when it comes to this type of issue or problem with a retirement fund? And is there a precedence as far as a potential lawsuit on the part of the receivers of the funds?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, in Minnesota, there's been only one pension fund that has gone bankrupt, and that was a teacher's fund. We did actually have some studies done a year ago, actually, by our pension staff to try to look at other states to find out funding sources, to find out just what other states were doing for pension funds, that are in trouble. And our staff spent a considerable amount of time trying to wait. Now, the trouble is, comparing Minnesota's pension funds to other states' pension funds, there's so many variances and differences from one state to another, from one fund to another. It's not always meaningful. But the bottom line is that ultimately you got to come up with the money to do it. And I think our staff did a very good job of kind of laying out various options. But you know, some of it was helpful and some of it just, you know, didn't quite tell us, well, this is going to be your answer here because ultimately it's going to take money.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, it just seems to me that it was the legislature that made the decision in 1979 for the MRF phase-out. And that really, I mean, I don't know what people were thinking back in 1979 about how this was going to work, because as new members became part of PERA, there was no new money coming into the system. So this day had to come eventually. I mean, I don't know if they thought that, you know, people would die before the pensions undied, which is kind of unrealistic and impractical. So it just seems to me that there were, you know, miscalculations or mistakes made back in 1979, and that's why I think the legislature ultimately has to be responsible, because we made this decision. We make these decisions about pension laws. You know, I mean, they can't do it on their own. They come in and they ask for something, or, you know, we gave them the high benefit increases during the boom years. We didn't have to do that.
Madam Chair, and as Mr. Martin indicated, not only did the legislature approve closing out the fund, which in the long range was probably the right thing to do, but then the legislature rejected the proposals by the city of Minneapolis over the next 2 years to roll the MRF plan into PERA, which at the time probably would have been the smart thing to do for long-term stability. Why the legislature refused to do that can, you know, this is a matter of speculation now for those of us who are here or were not here back then, but that was the decision not to roll them in now, and of course now we have to figure out how to undo them.
Further questions, Senator Gimsey?
Just a procedural question, Madam Chair. Once the Senator Betzel's committee has worked on this, and will it eventually come back here when they have a solution?
The motion will be to refer it to the Finance Committee. The Finance Committee will act on it. If it acts favorably, it will send it to the floor.
So, Madam Chair, we won't get another. If we vote yes to move this forward, we don't get another opportunity.
Only on the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And just to be clear, Madam Chair and Senator Gimsey, because the Pension Commission is not a committee of either the House or the Senate, all we can do is prepare a bill. The committee of origin in both bodies is the local state and local government committees. So the bill actually has, when I introduced it, it was actually referred to this committee. It's been sitting in this committee waiting for the pension amendments to come forward. Within about 2 weeks, you'll be seeing the rest of the pension package, again, on track in both legislative bodies, starting in the policy committees of state and local governments, and then moving off to where they have to do ultimately to the floor, because you have to go through the committee process in each body. The Pension Commission cannot do that. So we don't own any bills. All the pension bills that get introduced get sent to this committee, and then, you know, but the Pension Commission works on them before they take action.
Further discussion? Anyone else in the audience wish to comment on Senate File 2644?
Madam Chair.
Seeing none, Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 2644 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All who are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Betzel. We noticed council did in 2397, Senator Prettner-Solon's bill, that there needs to be a minor correction, and we might as well do that in the committee and have it right. So Senator Pappas moves that we reconsider the vote by which 2397 was approved. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Beg pardon? We now have Senate File 2397 before us. On the A1 amendment, we need to reconsider that amendment. All those in favor, Senator Pappas moves to reconsider the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senator Pappas now moves an A1 amendment with the following change incorporated.
on page 1, line 3 of the amendment, strike the S in terms, and on line 1-4, strike the word for. That will make the amendment language grammatically correct as per council's recommendation. All in favor of the A1, the modified A1 amendment, Senator Pappas's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 2397 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Senator Rust, welcome to the committee. We'll take up Senate File 2518.
I have not seen that amendment. I'm not offering it. Okay. We have Senate File 2518, and we had a delete everything amendment.
Have that in our pack.
Offered before, and we're actually going to have, since the work that's been done on that, going to offer the A4 amendment, which also is a delete everything amendment, which is really not very good form, but in order for people to see the engrossment of the bill, I think it just makes it easier to look at. So what the A4 amendment does is, and Mr. McGowan has kindly prepared a new summary for this delete everything amendment with regard to 2518. So it redoes compared to the, I hope this doesn't get too complicated, but compared to the.
This is an author's amendment, correct?
Yes, it is.
Well, maybe we should just adopt it and let you describe it.
Yep.
Senator Rust moves the A4 author's amendment to Senate File 2518.
Mm-hmm.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much,
have
Mr.
The bill
Chairman and members.
So the author
what's happened in the A4 amendment is if you look back at the A1 amendment again, is rethinking of the definition of what a meeting means, and also what how we deal with the definition of a public body. And there has been a lot of discussion on that, so that in the A4 amendment, we say that a meeting means a quorum of members of a public body assembling to attract, to transact public business. And in the A1 amendment, we had additional language talking about whether it was in person or is provided by law. And so that language now has struck from the A4 amendment. With regard to public body, in the A4 amendment, as compared to the A1 amendment.
We don't have the A1 amendment.
No,
so
I know. That's
we're not
the A1. I'm just
able
telling
to track
you what
what
the,
you're
I'm trying to explain what the differences are coming forward in the two main sections. One of them is the definition of a meeting and a definition of public body. Okay. And to explain what the progression of thought has been. So I'm just pointing out the differences between the A1 amendment that was before us in the first hearing on this bill and what changes have been made that are reflected in the A4 amendment, which we just adopted.
Okay.
Okay. So previously we had made reference in the to a quorum, and in the in the A4 amendment, that reference is deleted because quorum is defined as part of lines 131 and 132 in the definition of a meeting. The second part, or if you go to section 2 of the amendment, that is the there is no change made there in the or not really any major change with regard to closed meetings, except that we ask for we use different language to refer to it, a statutory citation rather than a statutory section. I mean, it's just trying to be clearer, is my understanding of it. In section 3 of the A4 amendment, there is no change from the amendment that we had previously. In section 4, we do refer to electronic materials, paper copies or electronic materials, which was the same as in the A1 amendment, but language about whether the public body needs to post the materials on its website, if it has one, if practicable, is omitted from the A4 amendment, and instead there will be a reference later on in the bill to the use of websites. In section five, the A1 amendment did not leave any discretion to the public body, and so it says here that adds the language in the A4 amendment at the end of line 3-2 as reasonably determined by the public body in terms of whether a meeting would be recorded and photographed in a manner that's not disruptive and doesn't interfere with the meeting, but it allows the public body to make a reasonable determination about what that may be. In Section 6 and 7 of the old amendment are not in this one. But instead of talking about a governing body, which in some states that's how they would refer to a public entity that represents some sort of government entity, we have defined in this bill public body, and so that language is changed there. In addition, the language also speaks to any meeting rather than just a regular meeting. And in section 7, there is a reference to special meetings and requires that if there is a going to be a notice of the meeting, that it can be put up on the door or some bulletin board, but if that's not readily accessible, that they have to find another place that would be accessible to the public for public viewing. So if it's not on the door of the building, the door of the room inside the building, if that doesn't work and it's not accessible, then the notice would go up on the door into the building rather than the door of the meeting room. Also made clear in lines 333 and then again on 4.3 when we talk about 3 days before the meeting, that it's a reference to calendar days. Then in section 8, there is a, in terms of the amendment that's before you, a return to language about a governing public body And then in the last part of that, which was also part of the original delete all amendment, that the provisions of the section are met if relating to publication, if it's in the state register, and then if it's on a state agency's. This is a state agency's now website. So that is the A4 amendment to Senate File 2518, and it is again an attempt to put into statute now some of the decisions about the open meeting law that were that have come about through case law, but that members of the public and interested parties have had difficulty following because those case law issues have not been part of the statutes. And when people would, as I understand it, when people would go to the statutes and try and find what actually are some of the requirements of the for the open meeting law, the statutes were silent or silent probably at best or confusing at worst. This amendment, I think, has been worked on by the, as far as I know, by the affected parties, and is was brought to me last Friday.
I'm raising my hand, and I'll recognize myself,
yeah,
I guess.
You can call on yourself, Lori, and go right ahead.
In Section 8 there, what is the reason for the governing public body rather than just the public body that we've defined in here? I'm curious. And then also, just a really technical thing, I think that should be the governing or the body rather than a body. I mean, if it's a body, then this would just be applicable to everybody as long as there is one body.
I would yield to Mr. McGowan. And why did we put, I mean, a governing public body was the same as was in the A1 amendment. Why was that not changed to just plain governing public body?
Madam Chair, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I'm not sure why that term is governing body is used in that case.
Because in every other instance, governing body was taken out and was just public body.
Yes, that would make
that may have been one that was missed.
Mr. Chairman, I think A is correct. But I think on line 419, let's see. Let's make sure I'm looking at the right one. On line 419, to strike governing.
Senator Rust moves the oral amendment on line 419 of the A4 amendment to strike the word governing on that motion. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, what was the other question you had?
The A there still doesn't. So it reads, the notice requirements of this section apply only if a statute governing meetings of a public body does not contain specific reference. It seems to me it should be the public body that we're talking about rather than a public body, but.
I think that's right.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we strike the, or a, and insert the then. If that makes it clearer what is being referred to.
Mr. Chairman, doesn't do any harm. I think the idea is to apply to all, I mean, any governing body, and it seems that A would be a governing body somewhere rather than a specific governing body. But I think it doesn't do any harm to use either term. A was intended to be more general, applying to any governing body.
And it's any governing body, again, if you look back at the beginning of of 416 for the meeting of a public body of an agency, board, commission, or department of the state. The notice requirements of this section apply only if a statute governing meetings of, no, I think you're right, the public body to which has been referred there. Yeah, I think the is better.
Okay.
I would agree.
Senator Rust moves the oral amendment on line 4.19, strike A and insert the. Everyone understand the amendment? Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of that amendment, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Amen, Mr. Chairman.
On the bill, then, any further testimony, Senator Rust? Any questions of members?
I think you have a list of testifiers,
Mr. Will,
Chairman.
We will open it up for testifiers, but I thought we would take questions of members. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rest, the section on special meetings, which is page 3 at the bottom.
It works.
There's a change on line 3.33, changing it to from 3 days to 3 calendar days. And that's consistent with our Senate rules on meeting notices. It says about, it refers to 3 calendar days. But what's not consistent is that in the Senate rules on 12.3, it says, to the extent practical, a committee, et cetera, must do all of their notices. In here, it just says you must do it. It doesn't allow for the to the extent practical. So are our Senate rules in violation of the laws here because we have an out where it says to the extent practical?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gerlach, the legislature is not subject to the open reading law, so we can have whatever rules we want with regard to our meetings. Although there are some people who think that the legislature should be subject to the open meeting law. I think it was in 1976 or so, there were changes made in the rules under which the legislature met to put into place those things that you're talking about and open meetings, but as defined by the legislature itself, mostly so that our caucuses could meet without having them open to the public. And those changes came about in the legislative rules in both bodies general openness in government following the Watergate scandal. And I think it was 76 that those changes got put into place. I don't know if Mr. McGowan knows differently.
Ms. Beyer-Krupinski, would you like to add anything? I saw you.
Mr. Chair and members, no, not unless you have any questions. We have certainly at line 1.32 addressed the question that Senator Betzold had last time. And instead of talking about whether or not people were meeting in person, we have just talked about a quorum assembling, which is a technology neutral. So they can still be assembling together both by various means, in person, tweeting, electronically, emails. It's whether or not they're transacting business. But one-way communication, like an email with meeting materials, would still be appropriate and wouldn't be a meeting under this definition.
Even if CC'd to all members, yes.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, we do have one testifier from the public. Mr. Neumeister, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Yes, we'll get that to you.
My name is Rich Neumeister. I just want to share something. Section 1. One of the things that is different between Section 1 that you adopted as the under the A1 amendment and this amendment now is if you take a look that you used to have under the definition of meeting where there's, now it's just to transact. Before you had where decide, deliberate, and discuss, which from my point of view gives more words, more opportunities to define what is open. the bottom line here is Section 1, in my judgment, I think may to some extent, depending on how public attorneys interpret this down the line, may close more than what, or close meetings down the line, which currently, depending on the entity or the city government or whatever, how they interpret this, will be closed. One of the things that that I just want to share with you is that if you take a look at the definition on 1.33, it talks about governing body. Governing body, even if we did it for Duluth or St. Paul, that's on the A4 amendment. What, you know, governing body, as defined in Black's Law, is a group of officers or persons having ultimate control. So it's some governing body who really has the control for that entity. And one of the concerns I have is the term governing could be used down the line if some other group, you know, is not, does not have ultimate control, that some public attorneys could assert that that meeting should be closed. Now, how you bypass some of that is argumentatively is on 135, where it says, or other similar body. Now, I don't know what other similar body is, and that's one of the things I also have a concern about. What you're basically doing is by case law, you've had all these lists of things. Now you're putting it in one definition, and one of the concerns I have then is how courts and attorneys and all these things are going to define those things. Now, these are just some questions that I raised in a letter to Senator Rest, and I want to share some of those with you now. One is, there is no definition of what governing body is. Why leave it up to judges and attorneys to define? Does governing body include, as an example, a task force created by a city council to review their street maintenance program with no elected officials on it? Or what is the term or other similar body? What does that mean? Now, as an example about that other similar body, what I handed out to you was Iowa's law for public, what they define for purposes of open meeting, and you can see how expansive that is. One of the other things, let's say the mayor or the governor says that there's an issue that needs to be addressed, and by executive order, a mayor or a governor decides to have a task force to take a look at an issue. Is that a public, is that for purposes of open meeting of our state law open, or is it not? Now, one of the, some of the case laws that I just, that I would like to just highlight is, there was a couple court cases. One is the University of Minnesota versus the the Minnesota Daily, which was in 1988. And it basically has said this. Open, and it, again, it uses that situation, but it the concept of it is applied to many other public bodies. An open meeting requirement of this section did not apply to a committee that was appointed by the regents to select the university president. And that case said that as long as a committee had the power to recommend and not decide, and members of the committee were neither regents nor appointed by regents, basically it did not fit under an open meeting law. And this has been interpreted like the commissioner of administration on some examples I shared with you in my testimony last week or 2 weeks ago, where if there's no decision-making power or authority, that someone could interpret that group may not be open to the public. That's one of the concerns that I have, and I don't know how far-reaching this is. In summary, I want to suggest that Section 1 be deleted from the bill. I think until we fully understand the implications of this, and unless, this is my view as a citizen, that policymakers go in depth a little bit about how this could have an impact, or maybe to take this opportunity to expand more openness in government,
rather than to articulate it, case law, I would suggest that that section be deleted. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Senator Rust, any response or reaction?
Mr. Chairman and members, I always appreciate the work of Mr. Neumeister, because I think he does make sure that when we are acting on matters of transparency and openness in government and data privacy, that we have some confidence in the bills that we're bringing forward. And in this instance, I think his reaction is an overreaction, and I think that the bill is a really good attempt to codify, make clear, streamline the what we know has happened in the courts in changing the scope and redefining the open meeting law, and it would be a disservice to citizens not to include the work of the courts in the statutes, and these changes have undergone a lot of review, particularly by the Departments of Administration's Information Policy Analysis Division. We've heard from the newspaper associations, from the affected local governments, and I think the bill is ready to proceed as it is.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, is there somewhere else in statute that says what it is to transact public business? Does it mean taking votes? Or I understand, like, if you're having a workshop that maybe you don't have to post everything, you're bringing in some specialists who are just talking about what's going on in other areas, and there won't be any action at all taken. It's just information gathering. But what is described as to transact public business?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, this just takes current language, which would use the plain meaning of transact. So it would still probably exempt those things like a training session where you're just receiving information, or your social gatherings, or we meet up at the grocery store just by chance. But that any time where you are taking in information and then making decisions and you are a public body, you are transacting public business. So we would just go to the plain meaning of those words.
So, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So if a body decided that at one meeting they're just going to take testimony and listen to concerns about an issue, but they're not voting, would that meeting still be one where they're transacting public business, or would only the one where they're planning to take votes be the one where they're transacting public business?
Ms. Beyer-Kuprinski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I think the language you saw 2 weeks ago might have made that distinction much more clear. I think what we've stayed with is current language, where there is still some area of gray around that. But I think that most people assume that you can't just take testimony without then having a follow-up question and starting to transact the business. But that folks were uncomfortable with saying every time a public body receives information, even if it's you're standing at a retirement party and someone hands you their resignation letter, that all of that is transacting public business. So because people couldn't, you know, kind of come to complete agreement, we stuck with what that transact public business and left it at that.
Which is the current.
Yeah. It's tough to find that balance. I know I served on the town board for years, you know, and we'd go to township trainings, and we always struggled with that. You know, I mean, hopefully at least two of us would go. Well, that's a quorum. And, you know, we would go and just receive information, you know, on road building standards and the like, you know, and we did not consider it a public open meeting. We were going and just receiving information, not about our specific thing, but we needed that ability to go out and get that training that allowed us to do our jobs well. So there's that balancing act that we're looking for, and I think that kind of gets to the heart of transacting business. And I hope that with the support of the Newspaper Association and folks like Mr. Neumeister, who will push us to make sure that we have as broad an interpretation as possible, it sounds like we're getting close to that right balance. I don't know. Senator Roebling, did you have further questions?
No, but it is hard to legislate common sense.
It is.
That's what we're trying to get
That's what we're trying to get at, I believe. Is that a yes. correct interpretation? Okay. Senator Olsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of agree with some of the discussion here between conduct and transact. To me, transact is probably more interpreted like making a motion and doing actual business, whereas conduct, well, it's interesting because I really don't see a whole lot of difference. In regards to having served in local government too, I think we made a point to always post, like if county commissioners were going to the township association meeting, they'd post it that the county board may go to the township association meeting, and then we could kind of, it would have been already posted, so there wasn't an issue if four or five commissioners showed up. But that's not too relevant to this, but I am interested in that definition of transact and conduct, because that does seem, transact to me, Senator Roebling, I think, had a good point about just a work session would seem more like conduct, and transact to me seems more like doing your business, paying the bills, and those kinds of things. So,
Mr. Chairman, in each version of the bill and amendments, we've used the word conduct, we end up again splitting hairs on how individuals interpret the meaning or the differences between the meaning of conduct and transact, and we're trying to get something again that would be a common sense clarity for members of the public, not necessarily lawyers who are interested in filing suit against somebody. And I think that the language what we have in general, again, and the notion of the plain meaning of words is something that we can all benefit from. So I think conduct is fine myself.
We have transact, though, do we not?
Yeah, we have transact.
But
beg pardon? Go ahead.
Ms. Beyer-Kropinski?
Mr. Chair and members, what we do have is at 1.32 we use transact, and at 1.34 we use conduct. Okay. So maybe using a consistent term would make the most sense. Thank you, Senator
Either
Olsen.
One.
Senator Olsen, you've got the authority to implement your choice, either one.
Mr. Chair, it's Senator Rest Bill, but...
I'm neutral.
Oh, Mr.
Totally
Chair.
Totally neutral.
In that case, I would like to see that at 1.32 that conduct replace transact.
Senator Olsen moves the oral amendment on line 1.32, strike transact and insert conduct. Everyone.
And I do think I appreciate that. And either way, to have the consistent
yes.
Terminology probably is a good thing for the public.
Good. Everyone understand the amendment. Senator Betzel.
Could probably just say do.
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 Public business.
Do public business.
No.
Never mind.
Do stuff.
We're not going to have yeah. do
in here. Well, it's going to save some ink.
Not neutral on do.
We have Senator Olsen's oral amendment in front of us. Any questions on that? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Olsen's oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. On the bill, any further discussion of members?
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator
I will
Rest.
Continue to, look at the wordsmithing of the bill, but I think it's ready to move on. And so I would move that Senate file 2518 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 2518, as amended, be recommended to pass. On that motion, any further questions? It's going to the floor. Anyone else from the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 2518? Seeing none, on Senator Rest's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, you may adjourn the meeting.
Thank you. There being no further business, state and local government operations and oversight stands adjourned. Thank you.